His leader was nearest him. He circled to get a clear stroke until he was less than a pace from where I hid. While he shifted his ground, I saw Vodalus wrench the knife free and drive it into the leader's throat. The axe rose to strike. I grasped the helve just below the head, almost by reflex, and found myself at once in the struggle, kicking, then striking. Quite suddenly it was over. The volunteer, whose bloodied weapon I held, was dead. The leader of the volunteers was writhing at our feet. The pikeman was gone. His pike lay harmlessly across the path. Vodalus retrieved a black wand from the grass nearby and sheathed his sword in it.
Who are you?
Severian. I am a torturer, or rather I am an apprentice of the torturer's liege, of the order of the seekers for truth and penitence. I drew a deep breath. I am a Vodalarius, one of the thousands of Vodalarii whose existence you are unaware. It was a term I had scarcely heard.
Here.
He laid something in my palm, a small coin so smooth it seemed greased. I remained clutching it beside the violated grave and watched him stride away. The fog swaddled him long before he reached the rim, and a few moments later a silver flyer as sharp as a dart screamed overhead. The knife had somehow fallen from the dead man's neck. Perhaps he had pulled it out in his agony. When I bent to pick it up, I discovered that the coin was still in my hand and thrust it into my pocket. We believe that we invent symbols. The truth is that they invent us. We are their creatures, shaped by their hard, defining edges. When soldiers take their oath, they are given a coin, an asimi, stamped with the profile of the autarch. Their acceptance of that coin is their acceptance of the special duties and burdens of military life. They are soldiers from that moment, though they may know nothing of the management of arms. I did not know that then, but it is a profound mistake to believe that we must know of such things to be influenced by them, and in fact to believe so is to believe in the most debased and superstitious kind of magic. The would-be sorcerer alone has faith in the efficacy of pure knowledge. Rational people know that things act of themselves, or not at all. Thus I knew nothing, as the coin dropped into my pocket, of the dogmas of the movement Vodalus led. But I soon learned them all, for they were in the air. With him I hated the autarchy, though I had no notion of what might replace it. With him I despised the exultants who failed to rise against the autarch and bound the fairest of their daughters to him in ceremonial concubinage. With him I detested the people for their lack of discipline and a common purpose. Of those values that Master Malrubius, who had been master of apprentices when I was a boy, had tried to teach me, and that Master Palamon still tried to impart, I accepted only one, loyalty to the guild. In that I was quite correct. It was, as I sensed, perfectly feasible for me to serve Vodalus and remain a torturer. It was in this fashion that I began the long journey by which I have backed into the throne. Chapter 2. Severian. Memory oppresses me. Having been reared among the torturers, I have never known my father or my mother. No more did my brother apprentices know theirs. From time to time, but most particularly when winter draws on, poor wretches come clamoring to the corpse door, hoping to be admitted to our ancient guild. Often they regale Brother Porter with accounts of the torments they will willingly inflict in payment for warmth and food. Occasionally they fetch animals as samples of their work. All are turned away. Traditions from our days of glory, antedating the present degenerate age, and the one before it, and the one before that, an age whose name is hardly remembered now by scholars, forbid recruitment from such as they. Even at the time I write of, when the guild had shrunk to two masters and less than a score of journeymen, those traditions were honored. From my earliest memory, I remember all. That first recollection is of piling pebbles in the old yard. It lies south and west of the Witch's Keep and is separated from the Grand Court. The curtain wall our guild was to help defend was ruinous even then, with a wide gap between the Red Tower and the Bear, where I used to climb the fallen slabs of unsmeltable gray metal to look out over the necropolis that descends that side of Citadel Hill. When I was older, it became my playground. The winding paths were patrolled during daylight hours, but the sentries were largely concerned for the fresher graves on the lower ground, and knowing us to belong to the torturers, they seldom had much stomach for expelling us from our lurking places in the cypress groves. Our necropolis is said to be the oldest in Nessus. That is certainly false, but the very existence of the era testifies to a real antiquity, though the autarchs were not buried there, even when the citadel was their stronghold, and the great families, then as now, preferred to inter their long-limbed dead in vaults on their own estates. but the Armigers and the Optimates of the city favored the highest slopes near the citadel wall, and the poorer commons lay below them until the farthest reaches of the bottomlands pressing against the tenements that came to line Gile held potter's fields. As a boy, I seldom went so far alone, or half so far. There were always the three of us, Drott, Roach, and I. Later, Ita, the next oldest among the apprentices. None of us were born among the torturers, for none are. It is said that in ancient times there were both men and women in the guild, and that sons and daughters were born to them and brought up in the mystery, as is now the case among the lamp makers and the goldsmiths and many other guilds. But Emar the Almost Just, observing how cruel the women were and how often they exceeded the punishments he had decreed, ordered that there should be women among the torturers no more. Since that time our numbers have been repaired solely from the children of those who fall into our hands. In our Matichin Tower, a certain bar of iron thrusts from a bulkhead at the height of a man's groin. Male children, small enough to stand upright beneath it, are nurtured as our own. And when a woman big with child is sent to us, we open her, and if the babe draws breath, engage a wet nurse, if it be a boy. The females are rendered to the witches. So it has been since the days of Emar, and those days are now, by many hundreds of years, forgotten. Thus none of us knows our descent. Each would be an exultant if he could, and it is a fact that many persons of high lineage are given over to us. As boys, each of us formed his own conjectures, and each attempted to question the older brothers among the journeymen, though they were locked in their own bitternesses and told us little. Ita, believing himself descended of that family, drew the arms of one of the great northern clans on the ceiling above his cot in the year of which I speak. For my part, I had already adopted as my own device, graved in bronze above the door of a certain mausoleum. They were a fountain rising above waters and a ship volant, and below these arose. The door itself had been sprung long ago. Two empty coffins lay on the floor. Three more, too heavy for me to shift and still intact, waited on the shelves along one wall. Neither the closed coffins nor the open ones constituted the attraction of the place, though I sometimes rested on what remained of the soft, faded padding of the latter. Rather, it was the smallness of the room, the thick walls of masonry, and the single narrow window with its one bar, together with a faithless door, so massively heavy, that remained eternally ajar. Through window and door I could look out unseen on all the bright life of tree and shrub and grass outside. The linnets and the rabbits that fled when I approached could neither hear nor scent me there. I watched the storm crow build her nest and rear her young 2 cubits from my face. I saw the fox trot by with upraised brush, and once that giant fox, taller than all but the tallest hounds, that men call the maned wolf, loped by at dusk on some unguessable errand from the ruined quarters of the south. The caracara coursed vipers for me, and the hawk lifted his wings to the wind from the top of a pine. A moment suffices to describe these things for which I watched so long. The decades of Asaros would not be long enough for me to write all they meant to the ragged apprentice boy I was. Two thoughts that were nearly dreams obsessed me and made them infinitely precious. The first was that at some not distant time, time itself would stop. The colored days that had so long been drawn forth like a chain of conjurers' scarves come to an end, the sullen sun wink out at last. The second was that there existed somewhere a miraculous light, which I sometimes conceived of as a candle, sometimes as a flambeau, that engendered life in whatever objects it fell upon, so that a leaf plucked from a bush grew slender legs and waving feelers, and a rough brown brush opened black eyes and scurried up a tree. Yet sometimes, particularly in the sleepy hours around noon, there was little to watch. Then I turned again to the blazon over the door and wondered what a ship, a rose, and a fountain had to do with me, and stared at the funeral bronze I had found and cleaned and set up in a corner. The dead man lay at full length, his heavy-lidded eyes closed. In the light that pierced the little window, I examined his face and meditated on my own as I saw it in the polished metal. My straight nose, deep-set eyes, and sunken cheeks were much like his, and I longed to know if he too had dark hair. In the winter, I seldom came to the necropolis, but in summer, that violated mausoleum and others provided me with places of observation and cool repose. Drott and Roche and Ita came too, though I never guided them to my favorite retreat, and they, I knew, had secret places of their own. When we were together, we seldom crept into tombs at all, Instead, we made swords of sticks and held running battles, or threw pine cones at the soldiers, or scratched boards on the soil of new graves, and played draughts with stones and ropes and snails and high-toss cockle. We amused ourselves in the maze that was the citadel, too, and swam in the great cistern under the bellkeep. It was cold and damp there, even in summer, under its vaulted ceiling beside the circular pool of endlessly deep, dark water. But it was hardly worse in winter, and it had the supreme advantage of being forbidden, so we could slip down to it with delicious stealth when we were assumed to be elsewhere, and not kindle our torches until we had closed the barred hatch behind us. Then, when the flames shot up from the burning pitch, how our shadows danced up those clammy walls! As I have already mentioned, our other swimming place was in Jiol, which winds through Nessus like a great weary snake. When warm weather came, we trooped through the necropolis on our way there, first past the old exalted sepulchres near the citadel wall, then between the vainglorious death houses of the Optimates, then through the stony forest of common monuments, we trying to appear highly respectable when we had to pass the burly guards leaning on their pole arms, and at last across the plain bare mounds that marked the interments of the poor, mounds that sank to puddles after the first rain. At the lowest margin of the necropolis stood the iron gate I have already described. Through it the bodies intended for the potter's field were borne. When we passed those rusting portals, we felt we were for the first time truly outside the citadel, and thus in undeniable disobedience of the rules that were supposed to govern our comings and goings. We believed, or pretended to believe, we would be tortured if our older brothers discovered the violation. In actuality, we would have suffered nothing worse than a beating. Such is the kindness of the torturers, whom I was subsequently to betray. We were in greater danger from the inhabitants of the many-storied tenements that lined the filthy street down which we walked. I sometimes think the reason the guild has endured so long is that it serves as a focus for the hatred of the people, drawing it from the autarch, the exultants, and the army, and even in some degree from the pale Kakajins who sometimes visit Urth from the farther stars. The same presentiment that told the guards our identity often seemed to inform the residents of the tenements. Slops were thrown at us from upper windows occasionally, and an angry mutter followed us. But the fear that engendered this hatred also protected us. No real violence was done to us, and once or twice, when it was known that some tyrannical Wildgrave or venal Burgess had been delivered to the mercy of the guild, we received shouted suggestions as to his disposal, most of them obscene, and many impossible. At the place where we swam, Jiol had lost its natural banks hundreds of years ago. Here it was a two-chain-wide expanse of blue nenuphars penned between walls of stone. Steps intended for boat landings led down into the river at several points. On a warm day, each flight would be held by a gang of 10 or 15 brawling youths. The four of us lacked the strength to displace these groups, but they could not, or at least would not, deny us admission, though whichever we chose to join would threaten us as we approached and taunt us when we were in their midst. Soon, however, all would drift away, leaving us in sole possession until the next swimming day. I have chosen to describe all this now because I never went again after the day on which I saved Vodalus. Trot and Roach believed it was because I was afraid we would be locked out. Eat a guest, I think, before they come too near to being men, boys often have an almost female insight. It was because of the nenuphars. The necropolis has never seemed a city of death to me. I know its purple roses, which other people think so hideous, shelter hundreds of small animals and birds. The executions I have seen performed and have performed myself so often are no more than a trade, a butchery of human beings, who are for the most part less innocent and less valuable than cattle. When I think of my own death, or of the death of someone who has been kind to me, or even of the death of the sun, the image that comes to my mind is that of the nenuphar, with its glossy, pale leaves and azure flower. Under flower and leaves are black roots as fine and strong as hair, reaching down into the dark waters. As young men, we thought nothing of these plants. We splashed and floated among them, pushed them aside, and ignored them. Their perfume countered to some degree the foul odor of the water. On the day I was to save Vodalus, I dove beneath their crowded pads as I had done 1,000 times. I did not come up. Somehow I had entered a region where the roots seemed far thicker than I had ever encountered them before. I was caught in 100 nets at once. My eyes were open, but I could see nothing, only the black web of the roots. I swam and could feel that though my arms and legs moved among their millions of fine tendrils, my body did not. I grasped them by the handful and tore them apart, but when I had torn them, I was immobilized as ever. My lungs seemed to rise in my throat to choke me, as if they would burst of themselves out into the water. The desire to draw breath, to suck in the dark, cold fluid around me, was overwhelming. I no longer knew in what direction the surface lay, and I was no longer conscious of the water as water. The strength had left my limbs. I was no longer afraid, though I knew I was dying, or perhaps already dead. There was a loud and very unpleasant ringing in my ears, and I began to see visions. Master Malrubius, who had died several years before, was waking us by drumming on the bulkhead with a spoon. That was the metallic din I heard. I lay in my cot, unable to rise, though Drott and Roach and the younger boys were all up, yawning and fumbling for their clothes. Master Malrubius's cloak was thrown back. I could see the loose skin of his chest and belly where the muscle and fat had been destroyed by time. There was a triangle of hair there, and it was as gray as mildew. I tried to call to him to tell him I was awake, but I could make no sound. He began to walk along the bulkhead, still striking it with a spoon. After what seemed a very long time, he reached the port, stopped, and leaned out. I knew he was looking for me in the old yard below, yet he could not see far enough. I was in one of the cells below the examination room. I lay there on my back, looking up at the gray ceiling. A woman cried, but I could not see her, and I was less conscious of her sobs than of the ringing, ringing, ringing of the spoon. Darkness closed over me, but out of the darkness came the face of a woman, as immense as the green face of the moon. It was not she who wept. I could hear the sobs still, and this face was untroubled and indeed filled with that kind of beauty that hardly admits of expression. Her hands reached toward me, and I at once became a fledgling I had taken from its nest the year before in the hope of taming it to perch on my finger, for her hands were each as long as the coffins in which I sometimes rested in my secret mausoleum. They grasped me, pulled me up, then flung me down, away from her face and from the sound of sobbing, down into the blackness until at last I struck what I took to be the bottom mud, and burst through it into a world of light rimmed with black. Still, I could not breathe. I no longer wished to, and my chest no longer moved of itself. I was sliding through the water, though I did not know how. Later I learned that the draught had seized me by the hair. At once I lay on the cold, slimy stones, with Roach, then draught, then Roach again, breathing into my mouth. I was enveloped in eyes as one is enveloped in the repetitious patterns of a kaleidoscope.